welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Swell.
I'm doing well, Sonny.
So, RebellerMedia.com, I want to give everybody a little bit of a heads up on this. It's a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report, but for Hollywood. And then after you're done checking out the day's headlines, we'll hope you will stick around for some of the Rebeller originals. We're highlighting well-known heroes of outlaw cinema, like Jean-Claude Van Damme, as well as lesser-known fare, like the movie Heartbeeps, which I had never actually heard of. Simon Abrams, a great writer for all sorts of websites. He secured an interview with the director of that cult classic for us. And if you've ever wanted to hear about a director talking about his like biggest misfire and also the fact that his house burned down while the movie was being shot, I have a great interview for you. It's that one. We're paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you'll sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access, either $2 per month or $20 for the whole year. That is less than most Patreons. And you get so much more bang for your buck. Now, on to the show. Up first in controversies and non-troversies, we take a look at kind of an evergreen topic. Hashtag Wes So White, or the unbearable whiteness of Wes. I'll let you guys pick which one you want to go with. That's right, it's time for the Wes Anderson discourse to fire up again, since he has a new movie coming out, The French Dispatch, about a fictionalized portrait of the rise of the New Yorker in the post-war era. It has all of the Wes Anderson tics, whimsy, center frame shots, quirk, twee, and you get the idea. As friend of the show John Podhoretz put it, it looks like Wes Anderson directed an homage to Wes Anderson, and that is why I love it. But some wags have decided to start the Wes Wars early, proclaiming the film to be yet another entry in Wes Anderson's problematic body of work. A reporter for the Los Angeles Times said the film lacked prominent actors of color. In the very same piece that she mentioned Jeffrey Wright, Benicio del Toro, Stephen Park, and Tony Revolori, who all are also in the trailer. I mean, Revolori might not be, I can't remember. But he gets a shout-out in the credits. Peter, I have a question for you. Why is it that we cannot have nice things?
Well, I don't know about you, Sonny. I have some nice things. I mean, I've got a large OLED television. Compared to plasma, it's just so much better.
How dare you?
The worst thing about these arguments always is that they start before anyone has seen the film. And there is it. Forget what who is in the cast or who isn't. Forget what it looks like. No one has seen this movie, and it is just completely ridiculous to be having a discussion about the meaning of this movie and its place in our sort of cultural debates and whether it's good or whether it's bad when no one has seen it yet. And it is just. It's just a kind of bonkers thing about like the take economy and how it has developed and bad movie takes that we have these fights weeks or months and in some cases, you know, a quite a long time before the movie comes out based on a single trailer and perhaps a director's history. And if anything, it's really weird to criticize this particular film since this actually seems to have the most diverse cast, one of the more diverse, at least one of the more and probably the most diverse cast of major actors that of any of the Wes Anderson films. Some of his earlier films really were almost exclusively white leads. That is not the case here. The other thing, though, is it's Wes Anderson is an odd target for this sort of liberal outrage, given that he makes movies about like the lingering historical horror of fascism and the ways that, you know, authoritarian societies, like, you know, the kind of the deep damage they do to our culture. Like, he's not some crypto conservative. He is a liberal to his bones and has made movies that with good liberal messages, great movies, I should say. I really like Wes Anderson, and it's just bizarre to be attacking him now based on a trailer and a Wikipedia page cast list.
I also think it's weird to launch this particular critique at Wes Anderson, because Wes Anderson makes movies that are in many cases self-consciously about white people. And there is a difference between making a movie that assumes that white people's experiences are the same as those experiences of all people of color in all settings, and uses white people as sort of a stand-in for humanity universally without understanding the ways in which that's simply not possible and true, and making movies that are sort of explicitly about certain kinds of whiteness. I mean, The Royal Tenenbaums is about sort of a set of, you know, semi-bohemian New Yorkers, and also to a certain extent is about how Gene Hackman's character, Royal Tenenbaum, reacts to his ex-wife dating a black man. Like, that's one of the subjects of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, The French Dispatch is about this very particular milieu of magazine writing, which frankly was very white for a long time. Moonrise Kingdom is set on the coast of Maine in this sort of, you know,
in Bernie Sanders territory. Pretty close. Super
and,
white.
Right. And so, I mean, they are movies specifically about the culture and stylistic affectations of these highly particular communities. And he is aware that they are highly particular. He is not trying to make them universal stand-ins. They are so obviously specific. And I actually think that if you are an advocate for diversity, this is a healthy thing. Movies that are aware that they're about white people and are about particular white subcultures, rather than universal stand-ins, are what we should be asking from movies with all white casts. They should be intentionally that way. They should be that way for a reason. And because white people have many subcultures, it's worth making movies that are particular to those milieus and particular to, frankly, like what a lot of white people do and behave like when people of color are not around. And again, like, Wes Anderson is just an incredibly weird kind of stand-in for this critique, because he is so hyper aware of the specificity of the settings in which he tells his stories. So I find this exhausting.
Like everything in his movie, whiteness in his movies, whiteness is an extremely particular and fussed over aesthetic choice.
You know, Alyssa, it's interesting though, because this is kind of a I want to say that the discussion around his films in particular is kind of emblematic of the way the discourse has gotten bad over, I think, the last 10 to 15 years. This kind of reduction of art to a series of boxes that you check. Does it have this many, this type of characters or this type of discussion? You know, how dare he set a movie in this culture and use it as a place for tourism, you know, as if the only places he should be allowed to are in Bernie country, right? I mean, I look at all of this and I find it deeply frustrating and also, like, kind of depressing, because it is just a signpost of how bad things have gotten in the cultural discussion space.
Right. Well, and I think that it is that this conversation is happening again is a sign of a conversation about diversity in Hollywood that has not necessarily matured beyond counting statistics and counting studies, which are incredibly important in quantifying what the industry does and is and chooses to represent. But well, they're not the end all be all. Well, I think that
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, it's a sign of a movement that has not moved beyond those counting studies to start talking about viable strategies, right? I mean, the solution is not for Wes Anderson to start making movies about black people. It's for there to be black and Asian and Latino Wes Andersons with their own, you know, highly particularized style and worldview, and with the backing to consistently make films on modest budgets. It's also, I mean, frankly, one of the challenges for a diversity movement in Hollywood is that there is simply the generalized whiteness of the entertainment industry has not necessarily produced a canon of, say, black actors or Asian actors or Latino actors who would be universally recognizable to American audiences, such that you can cast like a 50-person ensemble movie with them, right? I mean, you know, that is part of what Anderson does is emblematic of a larger failure of the industry, because the fact that he can do what he does and to cast his movies the way he casts them is a product of the whiteness of the industry. But again, the solution is not for Wes Anderson not to make movies. It's for many more people and many more kinds of people to have the sort of creative and stylistic freedom that Wes Anderson has.
And I would just say along similar lines, we don't have problems, I think, for good reason, when Ryan Coogler or Tyler Perry make movies with heavily black casts that are not emblematic of the kind of the general racial makeup of the nation of America, right? They are about specific cultures and about sort of specific places and specific groups of people. That's great. And, you know, Ryan Coogler in particular, I really like his movies and what he does with them. And it's not an issue if his cast is entirely black or entirely minority. It's and similarly with Wes Anderson, if he wants to go ahead and make a movie that is heavily white, that is about a white subculture, as Alyssa says, and is sort of aware of that, then I think that's something that can be useful. And I say can be useful, again, because I will just go back to my original point, which is that it's so hard to judge these movies before you've seen them, before anyone, as far as I know, has seen the movie, except possibly the people who are working on the film and financing it. And it's just, there is a real kind of rot in movie discussion right now, in cultural discussion, in that we are and that people start arguments about things and just want to fight and sort of preemptively, I don't know, cancel, like preemptively kind of take out and take down movies, directors, entertainers for products that no one has seen yet. And if you want to see this movie and say that this is a bad movie, that this movie has bad ideas or that it's insufficient in some way, I think that's totally fair and reasonable. But based on a trailer and a cast list, it's not helpful to anyone. It's not helpful and it's just kind of dumb.
Kind of dumb. Okay, so what do you guys think? Is the cast of The French Dispatch a controversy or a non-troversy?
The cast is a non-troversy. The criticism is a controversy.
Agree with Alyssa.
It is a non-troversy, the cast. The cast is a non-troversy. Leaving aside the fact that Wes Anderson can cast whomever he wishes to be in whatever movies he wants, the critique is not just wrong, it's a lazy rehash of previous wrong critiques. I mean, I can't believe that somebody watched that trailer and said, where are all of the actors of color? I literally think that they must have just not watched it. I honestly think they did. So anyway, it's a controversy.
Parts of the trailer were in black and white, so
hard to say. So exactly, it could be hard to say. That's right. All right, our main attraction this week is Birds of Prey, the contrabulous fabtraption of Professor Horatio Huffnuggle. I'm making a deep cut Simpsons reference. Sorry, Alyssa. I know you haven't seen a lot of Simpsons episodes.
Commander Coriander and our Gerrymander Salamander.
That's a Calvin
and Hobbes reference for the 80s kids out there.
Sorry. I mean Birds of Prey and the fantabulous emancipation of one Harley Quinn.
Known as Harley Quinn Birds of Prey.
Harley Quinn Birds of Prey. Not officially retitled, but all of the theater chains were like, okay, we tried to tell you guys this was stupid, so we're just doing it ourselves. We're changing the name ourselves. The bad girl from Suicide Squad, played with magnificently nutty charm by Margot Robbie, is back, having freed herself from the mental clutches of the Joker. Turns out that breaking up with Mr. J was something of a mistake, since most of Gotham, including one Black Mask, played by Ewan McGregor, wants her dead. To survive, she will have to team up with a whole team of badass ladies, including a police detective named Renee Montoya, the vigilante The Huntress, pickpocket Cassandra Cain, I'm sorry, and the strong-voiced Black Canary. Birds of Prey is something of a strange beast. It's one part Deadpool knockoff, down to the weirdly, temporally convoluted script, one part girl power anthem, one part well-shot action movie. The director of John Wick, Chad Stahelski, oversaw reshoots, since the original picture was lackluster in the action choreography department. All of those bits and pieces never quite cohered for me. They never quite came together. The way I have discussed it in another setting is, it's kind of like, you know, when you see a Word document and you see text that is like clearly a different size or a slightly different color or slightly different spacing, and you immediately realize that what has happened is somebody has cut and paste from another document or a website or something and put it in there. And it just makes you go, huh, I wonder what happened. Alyssa, As the show's resident woman, I was curious, what did you make of this mishmash? And why, for the love of God, did they not just call this movie Harley Quinn from the get-go?
I have no idea. This is actually something that I've been thinking about a lot, because this is, to a certain extent, kind of like the year of the superheroine, right? I mean, we have this. Black Widow is finally getting her standalone movie. We have Wonder Woman 1984 coming out. And one thing that has struck me is, you know, Hollywood has gotten fairly good at making superheroine stories, or creating superheroines who basically are, as to paraphrase a piece by Britt Marling in the New York Times recently, you know, guys, but who you want to look at naked, who, you know, there are superheroines who basically can do all of the things that men do, basically in the ways that men do them. They're good at fighting. They use the sort of same techniques. Their approach to the world is fundamentally like, there's a bad guy, we have to beat him, etc. And this is a movie that's very much like, here's a bunch of chicks who are good at fighting. And also, by the way, empowerment is measured by a metric that's literally like the number of times someone gets hit in the dick. But what Hollywood has not...
That's what we need a count of, is crotch shots.
Yeah, or shots to the crotch specifically. But Hollywood has not particularly figured out how to make movies about people who are superpowered and feminine rather than masculine. The closest they probably come is Patty Jenkins' Wonder Woman. And watching this movie, it seemed to fit in this, it felt in this sort of, fell in this uncanny valley for me, in that to a certain extent, it got, there were moments when Kathy Yan clearly seemed to have produced a movie that understood that for women, there are certain things about being a superhero that are just different, right? I mean, that moment when Harley Quinn asks Black Canary if she wants a hair tie while they're fighting was like, yes, okay, you have thought for 30 seconds about the fact that, like, the, you know, sort of long, flowy, sexy hair that all superheroines have, because, of course, none of them can actually be, like, butch, despite basically being men, would get in the way if you're fighting and you might want to get it out of your face, etc. But on the other hand, it's not a movie that has any, like, I mean, it's very much like girl power rather than any sense of what it means to, like, actually be a woman for any of these people. And so it didn't particularly appeal to me, like, as a woman or even as a story about female liberation. I mean, it's incredibly sort of shallow on that score. Its treatment of misogyny is just not that interesting. And it's, like, it's fine as an action movie, I thought. Like so many contemporary action movies, it's just too many quick cuts, too many close shots, you know, too much lighting that obscures the fact that, like, oh, it's actually stunt doubles doing this stuff. The closest it got to interesting me was everything involving Helena Bertinelli, or Huntress, Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character, who is the surviving daughter of a mob boss who has reemerged as, like, an incredibly socially awkward assassin, but only because she was the only character who felt particularly distinct to me in any way, and who was sort of not quite comfortable with the trappings of superhero identity. It's really pretty forgettable as a movie. It did not do very much for me.
You know, my one big disagreement here with you would be, I do think Margot Robbie is a very good Harley Quinn. I think she has kind of nailed that the inherent ridiculousness of that character and really leaned into it, which I think works. I think works for what she's doing there. And I also thought Ewan McGregor was very good. Ewan McGregor's Black Mask as this kind of, like, scene chewing, campy, like, slightly homoerotic vibe with his underling Thomas Zaz or whatever that guy's name was, there are, like, interesting subcurrents to that role that I think they could have tugged at just a little bit more. But I don't know.
But to push back on that a little bit, I mean, you know, we all really loved Margot Robbie in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is this sort of quieter role. It's more interior. And obviously Harley Quinn, you know, as we meet her, is not that.
I think this is objectively a better movie because she has more lines.
It's a good point. Peter raises a very, very good point here.
But the movie, you know, Birds of Prey cannot handle the fundamental, just incredible sadness of Harley Quinn's story, right? I mean, it reduces it to this jokey cartoon opener, but, you know, she's someone who was sort of actively thrown away by an abusive drunk of a father, physically abused by nuns in a Catholic orphanage. Despite all of that, you know, pulled herself together to become an accomplished professional person, and then totally subsumed herself in a man who abused and deformed her, really. And, you know, it makes that all really, like, cute and funny. And it's just not at all. And a movie that wants to be about emancipation in any real way, which this obviously doesn't because it's a Disney movie, not like a second wave feminist tract. Just
how dare you? This is a Warner Brothers movie.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. Yes, they're so different corporately, etc. speaking. Yes, I'm very tired. I apologize. But the movie just can't deal with any of that at all. And it's a shame because Margot Robbie can do that acting work, right? Like, we know that about her. She is quite gifted and really could handle that sadness and interiority if she was given room to do that. But the movie's just totally uninterested in, like, any actual trauma or sadness. And so it ends up being just very weird and shallow.
Now, Peter, this movie was not made for you, nor was it made for me, obviously, because we are men.
I don't know that that's true at all. Like, this is not a movie that's made for women either, in any meaningful way.
Well, this sort of raises the question that I think is actually a big question that I had walking out of this film that I said to Alyssa, who was this movie made for? And when you see most sort of conventional superhero films or even Disney princess films, and, you know, it's not a Disney movie, but it does feel a little bit like an extremely skewed and crazy Disney princess film at times. When you see those movies, it's clear who they are made for because you can imagine who the hero is supposed to be a model for, right? Someone would want to be Batman. Someone would want to be Captain America or Iron Man, Tony Stark, right? Like, these characters are models for their audiences, right? And so they're a better and more heroic and more interesting and more powerful version of someone that, you know, a 5-year-old or a 15-year-old might want to be. And it's not clear who Harley Quinn is supposed to be a model for. And this is, I think, a kind of fundamental problem, not with Margot Robbie, and maybe not even completely with the filmmakers, just with the character and the property who came out of the 1990s Batman the Animated Series and was not in Batman canon before then, and was a secondary character to Joker, and then became a breakout. Right, she became a breakout star because she was so interestingly voiced and drawn and sort of became more compelling in it. But she was always there as a supporting role, and she was also always a villain, and a supporting villain who doesn't have a kind of clear narrative, you know, a clear emotional connection to the viewer can be a very interesting character in some ways, but it's difficult to build a film around this character. Now, Robbie gave such an incredibly compelling performance in Suicide Squad as Harley Quinn the first time that you can see, oh, look, we've got a hot up-and-coming star. We've probably signed her for a couple of movies, so she's obligated to do this. We can do it on a somewhat lower budget. Let's go ahead and see if we can sell her in this character and in this role and make a franchise out of it. Not a completely terrible idea, and yet they couldn't figure out what it was about her that would make you want to root for her, that would make you want to be her in some ways. You know, they try to do it a little bit up front with the idea that that she's deeply traumatized, but then once you actually see the character, she's just sort of a messed up crazy weirdo.
She's just crazy.
Interesting, in certain ways, but the humanizing aspects of her character after you get past the animated prologue of abuse are, well, she's like us because she wants an egg and cheese sandwich. Okay, relatable.
She loves
and
her dog.
And she has a pet animated hyena who is obviously the real hero of this show and is going to be, you know, come back to that. We're going to talk about that. Well, we'll come back to that in our next.
And that same problem exists sort of for the rest of the Birds of Prey too, right? Like, Renee Montoya is, like, clearly an alcoholic. She may be right, but, like, her personal life is kind of a mess. And by the way, a huge sin of this movie is just wasting Ali Wong, who, I don't know if you guys have watched either of her stand-up specials or watched Always Be My Maybe, the romantic comedy she did with Randall Park for Netflix, which features a hilarious Keanu Reeves cameo. But, you know, so Renee Montoya is, like, kind of an unpleasant drunk. Like, she's one of those characters who is, like, she's right, but she's not right enough to redeem the fact that she's just sort of unpleasant. Black Canary is just not really a character. Like, we know she's good at singing and that she is justifiably scared of Chris Messina's character, but, like, she's not a person beyond that. Like, her mother got killed by the cops and that's bad, and she's sad now. You know, Helena, like, only sort of becomes a person in, like, the last 15-20 minutes of the movie, and, like, there's a lot that's promising there. I would watch, like, a, like, Helena Bertinelli dark comedy, but the only, like, you kind of have Cassandra Cain as, like, the spunky kid.
You
but
could
this...
call it the crossbow killer.
But so you have Cassandra Cain, who is, like, sort of this, you know, she's like Scout Finch, except Asian, but this is also an R-rated movie. It's not like 10-year-olds are gonna go and be like, I want to be like that awesome shoplifting tomboy. There's a weird sort of lack of emotional hook in the movie. And being like, oh, let's have a sleepover doesn't make it a movie for women. It's, yeah. I mean, this movie is directed by a woman of color, but it's like a very much internet dude's idea of what feminist liberation looks like, and also what girls do when boys aren't around. It's not made for you guys, but it's definitely not made like for me or by me.
Do you guys remember also Bridesmaids when it came out? There was this thing about how they'd inserted a particularly gross out kind of puking sequence.
Yep.
And that had come from Judd Apatow, I think, was the one who had suggested that. And he was like, if you want this movie to appeal to men, you need these gross out bits. And Suicide Squad seemed to me to often be kind of working under that same logic of, we want this movie to not feel too much like a movie that's made just for women, even though it will, of course, be constantly nodding to the fact that it is an all-female superhero team with a bunch of, you know, made by a woman, that there's all of the R rating often sort of justified a bunch of stuff that was like, let's do this part for the dudes who just want sort of gross out, vulgar, crazy, over-the-top superhero action or whatever.
Well, and also just, I mean, as a movie, one thing Peter and I were talking about when we walked out of the screening, the movie's conception of misogyny is so over the top, right? Like, I live, to be fair, in a society that, you know, like, constantly reminds me that I'm a woman, and sometimes in ways that are incredibly unpleasant. Like, I don't need to watch, you know, Chris Messina peel someone's face off to understand that he's bad or that, like, misogyny exists. And in fact, like, I don't, in a movie that's theoretically supposed to be something of a female fantasy, like, I don't actually want to watch that either. Which is not to say that the movie can't be about the bad things that men do to women, but there's something sort of off in the calibration and saying, like, hey, if you want to get to the part where girls hit guys in the crotch, like, we're just going to subject you to a lot of really intense nastiness first, right? It's like, it's almost as if, like, in order to earn your emancipatory payoff, we're going to make you suffer.
I think the movie is a mess, and I don't think it's like a man's conception of what women are like. It struck me as a, like, Twitter conception of what women are like. It reminded me a bit of the Black Christmas remake that came out recently, which, among other things, had a whole, like, 2-minute riff on why Camille Paglia is bad. And I was just like, this is like something ripped straight from Twitter. Why are you doing this? And so, like, the, like, hot girls for Bernie snippet in this, it just feels very, very forced and very online. And I don't really get it. I mean, look, here's my most controversial opinion about this film, which is that Harley Quinn is not a very interesting character, period. And she only really works in relation to either Bruce Wayne slash the Batman or the Joker. I mean, like, she actually only works as a character in relation to men, which is I think not true of somebody like Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman is a much more interesting character with a whole kind of a literal mythology about her, and even Captain Marvel to a certain extent. I had, you know, had its like weird lame girl power sequences with like the just a girl fight sequence, which I think caused Alyssa to literally groan out loud in the theater when we were watching it. Harley Quinn is just not an interesting character outside of the context of the men that she is surrounded by in the comics.
And there's a way to do girl power stuff that works and is fun for women. But I was saying, you know, one of the things I said to Peter is like, either you have to make this a much darker movie than it actually is, or you should just make it Spice World, right? Because, like, lean into the sort of sweetness and silliness of it. And this is a movie that has no sweetness, really. And its silliness is sort of half committed to and constantly soured by the, like, really gross out violent misogyny of it. And so you can do, the campy girl power stuff, but you have to lean into the girl part of that. And this is not a movie that does that.
Can I say that there one other thing before we move on? There is nothing in this movie that is as good as the moment in Wonder Woman where she sees the baby for the first time. You remember that?
Yeah.
Alyssa? Which like yeah. struck me as the sort of thing that shows like, okay, here is like a strong and powerful woman and also like kind of feminine, and also like merge those two things with like a clever comic beat in a way that I just, there's nothing like that here. It feels like what if Deadpool was a lady and could curse and drop F-bombs in a DC movie, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, Wonder Woman is just anchored by this profound sweetness and by, you know, not just treating femininity as drag or as, you know, an object of contempt. And I'm going to be really curious to see how they handle this in Black Widow, because one of the things that was sort of controversial about Marvel's treatment of her is basically the, like, part of her backstory is that she was sterilized as part of her training. And so she has this sort of uncomfortable, she, you know, is kind of a femme fatale when we first meet her, but she is also just sort of missing this theoretically essential part of womanness. And so, you know, nobody has quite cracked the code other, again, than Patty Jenkins with Wonder Woman on how you have someone who has a sort of maybe typically masculine strength, but thinks about using it in different ways and for different motivations than a male superhero might. I mean, the closest that anyone's really come to cracking that is in like Avatar: The Last Airbender, where you have these sort of different conceptions of power and superpowers that can be used sort of primarily protectively. And there's just none of that thinking really happening in mainstream superhero movies. And I think as folks try to make more superheroine movies, which frankly they're going to do because, I mean, any dollar that can be wrung out of this concept is going to be wrung. But I think if, you know, Disney or DC can't figure out a way to do this, there's always just going to be something a little bit missing. And, you know, having a world where we have like a kind of butch, probably gay Captain Marvel, where we have a sweet, you know, sort of feminine Wonder Woman, like having the whole range of those expressions would make superhero movies a lot more interesting to me. But this is not that.
All right, guys. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Birds of Prey?
Thumbs down.
I think it sort of felt like a first draft of a film that hadn't quite come together, I thought a lot of the ideas were good. And I didn't hate it. And if I have to pick, I'm going to actually give it a thumbs up.
Wow, I didn't hate it. The strongest possible recommendation. I came out of the movie thinking I was going to give it a thumbs up, and the more I've thought about it over the last week, the more I've disliked it. So thumbs down. This is a solid thumbs down. This week's assigned viewing is Jon Favreau's live-action Jungle Book remake. Peter, why are we watching Disney's foray into the world of their animated reboot fetish? I don't think this is the first one. I think the Alice in Wonderland, Tim Burton one, technically is the first of these, right? But this is the one that kind of set the template going forward.
Yeah, that's right. So we're watching The Jungle Book in advance of next week's The Call of the Wild. The Call of the Wild stars Harrison Ford opposite a CGI dog. Obviously, the dog's going to be the real hero here. And we're watching The Jungle Book in part because, not just because of The Call of the Wild, but because it is emblematic of the CGI animal movie trend that we have seen over the last couple of years. And in particular, in the first part of this year, where you have films like Doolittle, where you have and Peter Rabbit 2, which stars Margot Robbie, but also stuff, you know, over the last couple of years like Paddington, and Christopher Robin, and The Lion King, and Beauty and the Beast, and all of these animated films, the Jumanji franchise, which has done sort of monster business without anybody really, it's not clear like who the Jumanji fans in the world are, and yet people keep going to see those movies.
Dwayne Johnson, baby.
That's true, it's true. And big studios have figured out that you can make big money making big animals interesting with big computers, I guess. Sonic the Hedgehog, even with Jim Carrey, I would put in this category. You know, there's that old Hollywood saying, don't work with children or animals, but now everybody is signing up to work with an animated animal, and in part because The Jungle Book made so much money and showed what you can do with modern special effects. The movie is nearly photoreal in ways that were that are kind of impressive, and also to me really pretty creepy. And I like the original film, the original animated film, much better than this. In part because it doesn't attempt to cross the uncanny valley. It stays on the proper side of it. It knows its place, and it's more interesting to look at, more artful, and more sort of it feels more like a movie. And there's something almost uncinematic about both The Jungle Book and then Favreau's follow-up, The Lion King, which has essentially no human actors at all. It's entirely animated and all animals, and they just feel kind of creepy and unreal despite being really impressive on a craft level. Alyssa, Sunny, I don't have kids. Maybe I'm just the wrong audience for this, and maybe, and I mean, I gather these movies have made a ton of money, and they're family films. I did love the originals when I was a kid, and are they just sort of filling the same niche in the family-friendly movie schedule, you know, that the hand-animated Disney films that we saw as kids did?
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking sort of a couple of different things while watching this, and one of them is that going photoreal isn't just a little creepy, but it definitely makes some of the things that are already pretty scary in The Jungle Book even scarier. And I mean, to be clear, The Jungle Book is kind of a scary movie. It's about a kid who's out on his own in really lethal circumstances. And I think, unusually for a children's movie, involves the kid having to kill someone. I mean, this is not sort of a battle of wits type of thing. And it's not something like Aladdin, where, you know, the bad guy gets done in, but the person doing the doing in is in his late teens or 20s. I mean, this is a kid who's supposed to be, what, like 8 or 9? And so,
maybe even younger.
And so the photorealism actually made it feel much less kid friendly to me, because the idea of showing my kid, who to be fair is too young for movies, period, at this stage, although we did go to some parents and baby screenings while I was on leave, which was highly amusing. You know, I would not show this movie to a young kid, because I think the idea of saying, like, here's a live action you doing real violence to people, and this kind of realistic looking people getting crushed to death and burned to death, it felt less appropriate to me than the animated version it did. I mean, The animated Jungle Book is beautiful. It's a really just gorgeous movie and a reminder of how great old school animation can be. But that animation does create a little bit of distance. I mean, the iconic shot of Shere Khan like falling off the tree and into the forest is exactly the same in both movies. But, you know, there is a difference between the terror on an animated tiger's face and on an animated photorealistic tiger's face. Yeah. That makes it feel more violent.
I watched The Lion King, Favreau's follow-up here this week as well, and I was sort of shocked by how realistic the scene in which Simba's father dies. He falls off a he is sort of pushed off a cliff, and then it's the scene of a very real looking lion falling a great distance into a stampede. You don't actually see the thud, but you see it's enough of it, and you see the lion sort of like twisting in the air as it is realizing that it is falling to its death, and it's actually weirdly disturbing and like it's not traumatic anymore. It's just unpleasant to watch in a way that I hadn't expected.
Yeah, no, I remember when I saw The Lion King, I was totally put off by the fact that it is 100% a rehash of the animated original, with the exception of a terrible new Beyonce song. I mean, this is the thing that I hate the most about these animated remakes is the kind of fealty to the originals. And this is one reason why I actually like The Jungle Book, you know, leaving aside, I mean, obviously they borrow some of the same iconic shots, like you mentioned the tiger falling down, but they do other things interestingly and better, I think, for instance, the escape from King Louis's castle, which like is in Favreau's imagining, King Louis is kind of reimagined as almost a King Kong type figure. He's this enormous ape who is like so big that he is, and so lazy that he has like kind of grafted himself to the seat. When he gets up, there's like a tuft of hair underneath it, right? And he like chases.
Well, he's also Colonel Kurtz from Apocalypse Now, and that's explicit. I mean, Favreau talked about how they modeled it on Apocalypse Now and the Marlon Brando role. You're hidden in the shadows when you first see him, this sort of giant creature who rules over a crazed and maniacal part of the jungle that is even more deadly than the rest of it.
Yeah, and the way he's
sort of an
Christopher
it's an
Walken.
Interesting and odd cinematic reference.
But one of the things that go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I think you can look at The Jungle Book and The Lion King as the evolution of this whole Disney experiment, frankly, because like I said, The Jungle Book, for its various issues, and I agree with some of what you guys are saying, it does at least feel like kind of its own thing. In a way that the Lion King remake does not. The Lion King remake feels just totally, totally strapped to the original. And I like, you know, it is decadent in a way, in the sense of, you know, repetitious and like the sign of a society kind of lost to itself.
One thing I would say is that, I mean, it was interesting watching The Jungle Book as a parent, not so much because I felt like I was assessing whether I would show it to my kid, but because the way it's set up, it's very much split between being a movie about being someone's child and growing away from them, and being a movie about being a parent and learning to let your kid go and accepting that they will grow up sort of differently than you have planned. And that actually makes one of the more significant differences between the movies feel like kind of a cop-out, because in the animated version, Mowgli leaves the jungle, right? I mean, he comes to this village. He's afraid to go in. He sees this girl who sort of encourages him to come with her, and he leaves his original parents behind. And this ends, this remake ends with him like lounging in the trees with, you know, Bagheera and Baloo, and like he's clearly going to stay in the jungle forever. It's like a kind of, you know, Island of Lost Boys fantasy. And what it ends up saying is like, oh, you basically don't have to move out of your parents' basement. Like, you can move from your childhood bedroom to the in-law suite downstairs, but you don't have to go away from your parents and be different from your parents. And it kind of the movie actually, I thought, did a fairly good job of looking at the grief involved in letting go of your kid, accepting that they might be very different from you, and then just totally undercut that in a way that I thought kind of undercut the movie's power in the end.
Okay.
I did want to point out one notable difference, which is that in the original animated film, the Ka, the snake, is voiced by a man.
Yeah.
And in this one, it's voiced by Scarlett Johansson. Huge victory for feminism.
Yes.
Well, and this is what we know.
She's actually great, though. She's actually really good in the role. But it's just this, like, Favreau, when he explained it, was like, this movie felt like it was, like, too much of, like, a dude's movie. And I come on. Scarlett Johansson is just good in the role. Just say that it doesn't have to be justified on this sort of weird, like, let's have, you know, some sort of odd counting balance in the number of actors and like who's here. Yeah. She's really good in the role. She brings like a weird kind of like an actually good creepy sort of personality to it, right? It like the some of the stuff they do with her voice is really great, and it just doesn't need to be it doesn't need to be something about like, oh, this is, you know, we want to make this friendly to female viewers. Are there any women who are like, well, I wasn't going to see The Jungle Book,
but now Scarlett Johansson is a seductive snake and I will go.
Yes.
That is how I spend my... but no, the voice work in this movie is more effective than any of the photorealism, right? I mean, this is one of the better roles that Idris Elba has had in a long time, which says something about the roles that he has been given / is choosing. I mean, the voice casting is just uniformly outstanding.
The voice casting is very good, but I actually think the animation undercuts some of the excellence of the voice work because the animation is so photoreal. When the animals start talking, when they start emoting, giving sort of showing you what they're thinking with their faces, simple line drawings do a great job of blending animal features with human expressions
emotions.
And letting us see and relate to animals as sort of people-like creatures. And the photoreal experiment that we're undergoing, that Disney is doing here with all of these movies, I think actually makes it harder to relate to a bunch of these animal characters. I say this, like I said, I thought the hyena was the real hero of Birds of Prey. I don't have kids. I do have a giant dog who is like my best friend. And like relating to animals in a movie world is easier when they are either actually real, right? So like they're just a real dog doing a real dog tricks and having real dog facial reactions, or when they are hand drawn in a way that allows human animators to give them performances that these weird photoreal kind of muscular, you know, muscularly accurate animals that Favreau is creating with his computers doesn't do.
Okay, next week's assigned viewing is Upgrade, which we will be watching to prepare for The Invisible Man. That is it for this week's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. And I saw that, sadly, someone has finally given us less than 5 stars in one of their reviews. It was a 3-star review. And I'm going to take the blame for this. It was definitely because of that terrible Oscars for Assistance segment. That was poorly planned on my part. I'm not going to let you down like that again. If you don't love that or anything else about the show, please complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.